Today's Taisho will be on case 2 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, Yakujo's fox. When Yakujo Osho delivered a certain series of sermons, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the days of Kashyapa Buddha, the old days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a head monk living here on this mountain. One day a student asked me, 'Does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not?' I answered, 'No, he does not.' Since then, I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give the turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not?" Yakujo answered, "He does not ignore causation." No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, "I am emancipated from my life as a fox. I shall remain on this mountain. I have a favor to ask you. Would you please bury my body as that of a dead monk?" Yakujo had the director of the monks strike the gavel and inform everyone after the midday meal that there would be a funeral ceremony for a dead monk. The monks wondered at this, saying, "Everyone is in good health. No one is in the sick ward. What does this mean?" After the meal, Yakujo led the monks to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain, and with his staff poked out the dead body of a fox and performed the ceremony of cremation. That evening, he ascended the rostrum and told the monks the whole story. Obaku thereupon asked him, "The old man gave the wrong answer and was doomed to be a fox for 500 rebirths. Now, suppose he had given the right answer, what would have happened then?" Yakujo said, "You come here to me and I will tell you." Obaku went up to Yakujo and boxed his ears. Yakujo clapped his hands with a laugh and exclaimed, "I was thinking that the barbarian had a red beard. Now I see before me the red-bearded barbarian himself." Mumon's comment: not falling under causation, how could this make the monk a fox? Not ignoring causation, how could this make the old man emancipated? If you come to understand this, you will realize how old Yakujo would have enjoyed 500 rebirths as a fox. Mumon's verse: not falling, not ignoring. Two faces of one dice. Not ignoring, not falling. A thousand errors, a million mistakes. Just so everybody is clear about this, great master Hyakujo, Bai Jiang, in Chinese, this is the master Bai Jiang, Sifu. When Hyakujo was teaching at his temple, Bai Jiang, he would deliver Taisho. And every time he would deliver Teisho, a mysterious old man would come in and sit in the back of the room and listen to his Teisho. And one day, all the monks leave after the Teisho, and Hyakujo encounters the old man and says, "Who are you standing here before me?" And the old man says, "I look like a human being. I take on human form, but actually I'm a fox. And the truth is that I was a human being long ago, at the time of the previous Buddha, not the time of the Buddha of the current world age, Shakyamuni, but the previous Buddha, Kashyapa Buddha, the Buddha before the current Buddha. So long, long time ago, kalpas ago, I was the master of this temple. I was the teacher on this temple. And a student came up to me and he asked me a question. He says, is a person who has had Daikensho free from causation? In other words, free from cause and effect, free from the world of form and ordinary action and ordinary consequences. So once you've had Daikensho, basically, any problems, any confusions, any difficulties? So does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of cause and effect or not, under the normal way things are? And I said, no, he does not. And so he caused this monk, the master caused the monk who asked the question to become very confused in his practice. And as a result of his confusion, many years were spent going up blind alleys and making many mistakes and so on. And perhaps this monk never managed to make much progress in his practice because of the advice of the teacher. So as a result of this, the teacher was subject to 500 rebirths as a fox, and still stuck in foxhood, and goes to see Baijiang, goes to see Hyakujo, and says, "Can you help me? What answer should I have given?" And Hyakujo says, he does not ignore causation. He does not ignore cause and effect. This is a wonderful koan, really very important koan, and it's interesting where the koan is placed in the Mumonkan. In the Mumonkan, koan number one is the Mu koan. So when you start doing Zen practice, if you train under the, at least in traditional way in the Rinzai lineage, your teacher usually asks you to work with the breath meditation initially until you can enter samadhi. And then the teacher will ask you to work with the mu koan. And now it's interesting that after the mu koan, there's this koan. So my feeling is that Master Mumon thought this koan belonged right after the Mu koan. There's something about the Mu koan that requires this koan to follow. And I do indeed think that these two koans go together in very important ways. Very important. So some of you have been practicing for a fairly long time. There are people in this room who have been practicing for 10 years. In fact, there are people in this room who have been practicing for 30 years. And there are people in this room who have been practicing for less than a year. There are people in this room who have just come to the Saturday sit, the whole Saturday sit, for the first time. So, basically different people at different levels. And if you've been practicing for 10 years, you might forget what it was like to practice initially. And the more you sit, the truth is, I promise you this, if you stick with it long enough, your practice is going to make your life very happy, make you very happy. And at some point, you may even forget how unhappy you once were, that happy. You know, people come to see me sometime, and they will talk to me about the things that make them unhappy, especially beginners. And people will come and talk to me privately, and they'll say, you know, I have a lot of problems with anxiety. I'm anxious all the time. Or somebody will say, I have a lot of trouble with anger. You know, I'm very angry a lot of the time. I get really upset. And people will tell me other problems. You know, my girlfriend has left me, and my heart is broken, and so on. And real distress. And I generally offer the same advice, no matter what. You know, it's my job is actually a very easy job, because they tell me this, and then I'll just say, well, I think you should do more zazen. You know? So they'll say, you know, I have this incredible tension, I feel tense all the time, I feel anxious, I can't sleep. Ah! You know, I think you should do more zazen. My girlfriend has just left me, I'm broken. What'll I do? More zazen, right? This drives my wife crazy, as you can imagine. Because she'll talk about anytime there's a problem, it's like she says, you have two answers for everything, exercise, you know, and zazen. Well, generally that solves the problem, you know. If you have been practicing a little while, you know that actually these do help enormously. You know, they really do help enormously. You know, I can remember in college, just speaking from my own experience, you know, when I was in college, a number of things happened to me that are typical, but they all happened at once, you know. Coming to college is sort of a wrenching experience for a lot of people, because you leave your home and the world you grew up in, you leave the values you were raised with, and you're suddenly living with people who have very often very different values and attitudes, very different way of life. And you can go through kind of a personal crisis just through that experience alone. It's rather disorienting suddenly to be in a place where your values are not the universal values. And that in itself can be quite disorienting. Usually people in college who come to a university go through a little process, like a little breakdown. Just, you know, you realize, oh, you know, other people didn't live the way my family lived. Other people have different outlook and so on. And it can be quite disorienting, and sometimes wildly disorienting, you know. Sometimes people go through a little crisis because of this, and I certainly did. And then at the same time this was going on, my parents got divorced, and my dog got hit by a car. It was just like, and what else, you know? So all of this sort of added up when I was about 18 years old to kind of a sort of low-level depression all the time. And I can remember just walking down the street in this gray, this really gray mood, you know, really like, I think I didn't go to like a counselor, but I probably should have, because I think I was really depressed, you know. And at this time also, we were at war with Vietnam. And the war bothered me very much, because I thought it really was an immoral war. And there were very large numbers of American casualties. People who object to the war in Iraq today have seen, you know, casualties. We've had 2,000 people, but I think the casualties in Vietnam exceeded 70,000 people. So a huge number of Americans were killed, and vast numbers of Vietnamese were killed. Maybe more than 1 million Vietnamese were killed. So on the personal level, a lot of things in my life were not going very well. You know, for example, when everybody would leave for the winter break, I really had nowhere to go, because my parents were divorced, the house was gone, you know, and so on. Other personal things were not going well for me. So I was in sort of like a perpetually bleak mood. And I think this lasted for a very long time. And, you know, I began to get interested in meditation on and off, but when I met my first teacher, Genki Roshi, I began to sit. And I had a lot of personal problems at that time too. You know, I was I eventually decided to go to graduate school, and that created all kinds of stress. And until then, I had a very couple of jobs that were very low-paying jobs and stressful, and didn't get a lot of respect. And so I had anxieties, sort of low-level depression, and so on. I think this is very common. I mean, maybe my case is unusual, but I doubt it. You know. So I started sitting, and at some point, you know, that sort of low-level, low-grade depression was really a thing of the past, and it has never been back for, I don't know, 25 years, honestly. And anxiety, of course, we all have anxiety, but that kind of consuming, constant anxiety is a thing of the past. If you've been practicing for a while, it's easy to forget how much this practice changes you, because it happens in very gradual ways. You come in and sit, and then you come the next day, or you sit the next day, and you sit the next. It's just like growing. You know, if you're growing up, you grow a centimeter at a time, you know, centimeter a day or something, so probably not even that much, right? Millimeter a day. So doesn't seem like you're getting any bigger, but one day you're 4 feet tall, and the next day you're 5 feet tall. A year or two later, you're 5 feet tall. So it's that kind of slow change. It's very subtle from day to day or week to week, but one day there's a real transformation, real change. And if you've been sitting for 10 years or so, or 5 years or so, you might forget, actually, just how depressed you used to be, or how nervous you used to be, or angry you used to be. But it's worth remembering, just for a minute, you know, what that was like. One of the Buddha's early discourses is really very powerful. In English, it's often called the Fire Sermon. And basically, Buddha was talking about the condition of the ordinary mind. And he says, famous words, he says, you know, the eye is on fire. It's like on fire all the time. He says, the ear is on fire. The mind is on fire. I is on fire with fear, you know, and attachment and anger, you know, and the ear is on fire with fear and attachment, anger, and so on. And it's a very good description, really, of what it was like for me from the time I was about 16 or 17 until maybe 3 or 4 years into my Zen practice. It was like my life was on fire. And I think this is quite common. I think a lot of people are on fire a lot of the time, you know, with anxiety or anger or fear and so on. Especially when you're young, I think life is so disorienting. You know, I think that in our culture, you know, some cultures are very simple in that you have very few options. And that's not necessarily a good thing, I agree, because, you know, we can be more creative. You get to sort of create your own life in our modern world. That's great. People don't tell you, here's how you must live. But on the other hand, you get all of these conflicting instructions, right? My father used to tell me, you know, study what you want to study. My mother always used to say, you know, you've got to get a job. And she wanted me to be a doctor because I was good in science. And it just broke her heart when I went into the humanities. Instead of, you know, because she just had this vision I was going to be a doctor. And when she was old, I would, you know, put her up in a nice house. And now she'd have a nice car. And she wanted the best for me. You know, actually, I'm making fun of her motives. You know, she really wanted the best for me. And she wanted me to be the most prestigious thing she could think of, which was a doctor. You get conflicting instructions, and they don't add up. And the society itself is very much like a maze or a labyrinth, you know. People even take advantage of your confusion, right? I mean, you see this all the time. So, you know, you can go this way or that way. You can do this or you can do that. And the more choices you make sometimes, the more you feel like you're lost. You get more and more lost, more and more confused, and more unhappy. This is quite typical, I think. And people are constantly looking to authority figures to help them decide what to do. So, you know, when I was very young, a friend of mine took me to my first rock concert when I was about 17 years old. And we went to see a group called, you probably have never heard of this group, but they were called Jethro Tull. Jethro Tull. And they were just starting out. And at this time, they played in a small place called Wolf Trap Farm outside of Washington, D.C. At that time, Wolf Trap wasn't as big as it is now. And they were just starting out, and there was a man with long hair who played a flute, which was very unusual in rock music. And these people were the most extraordinary humans I had ever seen. First of all, I'd never seen a man with hair down to his waist before. And he had, you know, I was growing up on military bases, right? So men didn't have long hair like that. And they didn't wear striped pants like pirates. And they didn't have rings in their ears, you know, and so on. And it was very exciting to see them. And after that, I thought, you know, I think I'm going to grow long hair. This is how we make our decisions a lot of the time, right? You know, you see something and you go for it. You don't know what the consequences are going to be. You don't know where it's going to take you. This is the adventure of life, but you can get very confused, right? A lot of my contemporaries, a lot of people who were my age, you know, we loved these rock stars, but, you know, they were all shooting up on heroin. And a fair number of my friends developed drug problems. I was very lucky that I didn't do that for some reason. But I have friends who developed like serious drug problems, and it was all because they went to rock concerts and saw very beautiful people with long hair and colorful clothes and thought, well, you know, Jimi Hendrix is doing it, maybe I'll give it a try. You know. This is how we make our decisions, right? You know. So anyway, the mind really is, at a certain stage in our lives, or if we live a certain way, really is on fire. The eye really is on fire. So, you know, we begin to do Zen practice, and you learn how to sit on the cushion and watch the breath and stabilize the mind. And at some point, you know, that nagging feeling of tension or that undercurrent of fear begins to diminish a little bit, yes? And the constant mental chatter begins to lighten up. And there are these moments where, you know, the mind is stable, calm, balanced, and quiet. And it's beautiful. It's like walking out of a noisy room and stepping, going up some stairs to a balcony where it's absolutely quiet, and maybe the, you know, just the wind is blowing through the trees. All the roar of conversation is gone. And it's still and it's quiet. It's just a beautiful place to be. And all that tension in your body that builds up, you know, all the time, suddenly gone. So the body is smooth and clear, like a lake without any wind. Yeah? And the mind's like an empty sky with no clouds. It's this beautiful state of being. Beautiful, you see. This is a samadhi. And the next stage of Zen practice is the cultivation of emptiness meditation, mushin. And this is like a deepening of the samadhi state, deepening the samadhi state. In this condition, it really becomes possible to be liberated from our fears and our anxieties and our anger and so on, and beautiful, into this beautiful condition, right, that I just described. Beautiful state, like floating on the water. Like, you know, mind is like a cloudless sky, body's like a lake with no wind. Right? We don't always hit this state, but when we do, it's just beautiful, just wonderful. And, when you're in that state, you sort of want to live there forever. It's like this could go. I could go with this for a while, like for the rest of my life. Very beautiful. And mu is also actually a beautiful state of being, because in mu everything disappears, everything. But there's this wonderful life energy. Sooner or later, this beautiful life energy begins to arise spontaneously. And again, it's like this is heaven. This is heaven. Is heaven. In this state, you know, there's a feeling like I don't want to come down. I don't want to leave this beautiful place. So this koan is really addressed to people who are able to enter deep samadhi and deep mushin. Deep samadhi, deep mushin. It's a saying, in a way, you probably remember how confused and in pain you were at one time. And you also understand how beautiful it is to be liberated from that. You know, to be liberated. But there's a danger in that liberation. Danger in that. In beautiful samadhi state, beautiful mu state. You know, what danger? Well, it's possible to become sort of addicted to samadhi, believe it or not. It's possible to become addicted to mushin, believe it or not. You can, if you're not very careful, begin to use these states of mind as a way of closing doors instead of opening doors. This is really quite important. When people first enter samadhi, have the first samadhi experiences, it's so beautiful. It's like it's like getting a good night's sleep after weeks of sleeplessness. It's like being thirsty and having a cool glass of water. You know, it's just such a beautiful experience. Eventually, you know, people can enter samadhi quite easily. If you practice meditation fairly often, eventually you'll be able to enter that beautiful samadhi state quite regularly. There are many people who never progress beyond that condition. That's a moment in Zen practice when some people simply quit practicing formally and they decide, this is as far as I want to go. This is where I want to stop. Because it's so beautiful. But actually, that's a very dangerous thing to do, because if you stay in that state, if that's as far as you go, you know, actually, you can become a very selfish person. Very selfish person. You're really just cutting yourself. You can really cut yourself off from the world and from other people, and you can just linger in this very beautiful state. In fact, this is sometimes called the cave of poison grass, right? Because it's so beautiful. You just go there and linger. As soon as you can enter samadhi, your teacher should say, hey, you know, wait a minute, grab you by the shoulder and say, now we're going to do mu, right? Mu koan is a challenge for somebody who can stay in that beautiful samadhi state, right? Mu is difficult again. Uh-oh, the pain is back. The frustration, etc., etc. It's like, oh no, here I go again. Back. I thought I had escaped from all that, right? And you work with mu, and you work with mu, and then there's a beautiful opening, and this wonderful energy flows through your body. And again, you can stay there for a long time, forever. The teacher says, on to the next koan, right? And the next koan is this koan, a fox koan. This is about a monk who became stuck in maybe samadhi or maybe mu, that beautiful state of samadhi, that beautiful state of emptiness, right? Stuck. Began to practice in a way that closed doors instead of opening them. And this is very common and very, very subtle problem that many people are never able to overcome. You know, where you become, Zen is really not about peace. It's not about peace. And it's not really about stillness or silence. Those are all limited perspectives on what we're doing. It's not about silence and it's not about noise. You know, it's about both, right? Both of these are fundamental aspects of reality. As soon as we begin to discriminate between a state of being that we like and a state of being that we don't, we're already sort of in trouble. This is actually called fox Zen. Fox Zen. Yeah. And it's a kind of, you know, when you begin to do meditation, you begin to feel your self-consciousness disappear. So if you've been practicing for a couple of months, when you sit down on the cushion, that sort of internal dialogue begins to go away, and you start having these on-self-conscious moments of awareness. The self is just sort of gone, and you're purely in the moment. See? And at that point, you think, well, this is like selfless awareness. You might interpret it that way. But actually, you know, if you cling to that condition, if you stay in that state, you become more selfish than ever. There's a kind of a, sort of a spiritual narcissism that's quite common in the East and in the West, you know, where people are, they use these practices to insulate themselves from a bigger experience of life, or to insulate themselves from pain and suffering. This, as I say, is called Fox Zen. And there are even great teachers, so-called, you know, who have had deep experiences of awakening, who still kind of use those experiences to protect themselves from new possibilities that might put at risk their security, safety, sense of comfort, and so on. You know, one way to think about Zen practice is that we're always in samadhi, always in mu, but we're also always engaging with things we may not particularly like. You know, that may be difficult, may be unpleasant. See, as soon as you create a boundary between what you like and what you dislike, you're closing yourself down all over again. And it's very easy to do this in Zen practice, to become sort of addicted to beautiful, calm stillness. And there's two sides to Zen practice. You know, one is cultivating beautiful, calm stillness. The other side of our practice is engaging with the world of form, right? The world of cause and effect. Cause and effect. As you know, we have sitting at a lot of different locations. So when I'm not on my job, I spend a fair amount of time driving around the state of New Jersey. And so I listen a lot to NPR. And I didn't get to see the skating competition, the women's skating competition. But some of you probably heard about it, you know. The American contestant, Sasha Cohen, fell during her event. And also the Russian, I can't remember her, Slutskaya, fell. These are like two superb athletes, right? And it was so interesting to hear what they said. It was so interesting to me, you know, because first of all, Sasha Cohen went through this similar defeat 4 years ago, and I heard her on the radio, and it was so wonderful what she said. She said 4 years ago, when this happened to me, I got so angry. I was just so angry and bitterly disappointed. And then basically she said, you know, now I'm so grateful just to be here. I've gotten so much out of this. It's enriched my life so much. See, I just thought that was wonderful. You know, that's really a wonderful response. And Slutskaya also had a very good response. You know, she was almost laughing. She said, it's funny. She said, you know, I make those jumps every day. You know, and she said, and I give exhibitions and I never miss. You know, and she said, for some reason, I missed. And I just admired both of them so much because they were not overwhelmed by what had happened to them. And that spirit is exactly right. You know, I think they've both realized that they're not skating to win. They're skating because they love it, see. And so, you know, the challenges, the failures, don't take away that fundamental love that they feel for what they're doing. In fact, you're bound to fail. You're bound to fail over and over again, right? So it's how you do things in life. It's not whether you know, it's the old cliche, it's not whether you win or lose. It's how you live your life. This is what Zen is all about. So the whole purpose of this practice is to open ourselves up to life, right? To live an open life. And that means we're going to fail. We're going to fall down. We're going to make mistakes. And we cultivate an empty mind, big mind, stable mind, so that when we make those mistakes, we're not knocked to the ground, yeah? This is the proper understanding of Zen practice. It's like there's two hands to our practice. One is stillness, and the other is engagement, right? It's like, this is a mu xin, everything disappears. And then the other hand is reaching into the world, right? Reaching into the world. These two things go together, always. And of course, every time you try something, you're going to fail. It's absolutely guaranteed, right? It's guaranteed. You know, you can be the best in the world. Slutskaya was supposedly, you know, everybody said she had it, or Cohen had it in the bag, right? And she's done it a million times and she fell on her ass. Inevitably going to happen if you engage with the world. So Fox Zen is the practice of someone who doesn't try, right? Doesn't engage, but says, you know, I'm going to stay here in this beautiful stillness and try to like minimize my risk, or not go out there on a limb. And this is all people have this problem. The Dalai Lama has this problem. This is a continuous problem for all human beings, you know. How do we really embrace life fully? You know, and all of this training is to create a person who can be totally open to life. And it's not easy to do because we know failure is going to happen. And, you know, actually, when we stay in samadhi, we sort of cling to samadhi, or when we cling to mushin, that's a kind of very subtle egotism. It's very subtle. See, I mean, once you can enter samadhi, and once you can enter mushin, it really is a matter of, takes courage, and you have to let the self go to then embrace the world, then reach out to the world and take a risk, and you know you're going to fall down. See, that's really letting go of the self. Really letting go. That's a deeper kind of letting go of the self. When we sit on the cushion, self disappears. When we enter mu, everything disappears. But when we then, you know, take our GREs, go for a job interview, try to write our dissertation, whatever we're doing, you know, whatever we're doing, we you know, that's a deeper loss of self, actually deeper loss of self, in my opinion. And that's the frightening part. You know, I think that's very frightening for people. At each of these stages, people have to sort of give up a little bit of the self, right? When you start sitting on the cushion and you begin to enter samadhi, it's so pleasant, most people don't mind giving up the self. You know, when you begin to work with Mu, that's where a fairly large number of people quit doing Zen practice because they realize, wait a minute, I'm really going to have to give up myself. There's a kind of giving up the self also when you engage with the world and you know, I'm going to make a fool out of myself, I'm going to fall on my face, I'm going to write this and somebody's going to send it back and say it's no good. And as I was saying, even very advanced people can still use their mushin to hide from the world. You know, I've known teachers who are very far advanced, but you know, sometimes they'll make a judgment call that's just a bad call. And I've known Zen centers where the teacher, sort of sits on the cushion and enters deep mushin and says, here's what we're going to do, you know. And then they do it and it's a disaster, right? And students come to the teacher and say, you know, it's not turning out very well. In fact, it's a disaster. And the teacher sort of can't hear it because he's thinking, well, I'm the great so-and-so. And this person, too, is also blocking, is also afraid of life, afraid of life. I've mentioned this before, but, a number of years ago, I had a chance to see a Tibetan teacher. I had a chance to hear a Tibetan teacher. I can't recall his name right now, but it was so interesting because at the beginning of his talk, he asked people, what's the first characteristic of an enlightened person? And people stuck their hands up and, one person said, totally compassion. Another person said, free from birth and death or something. Another person said, clairvoyant or something like that. And the teacher said, actually, no, the first characteristic of an enlightened person is makes mistakes. And I just thought that was so, at the time I didn't understand this, but now I understand that is such a wonderful insight. So even deeply enlightened people can fail their PhD exams. Did you know that? Even deeply enlightened people, there was a story in Japan about a famous Japanese ball player that my first teacher, Genki Roshi, used to tell this story all the time. His name was Sadaharu Oh, and he was like the Mickey Mantle or the Roger, I don't know who, I don't even follow sports, I'm sorry, but the Babe Ruth of Japan or something. So anyway, he went into a hitting slump. He was a good hitter, and he went into a slump, and so he went into a Zen temple, and he trained diligently at the Zen temple. And so Genki Roshi would always tell this story, Sadaharu Oh was having a hard time, and he went into a Zen temple and he did Zazen. And then somebody asked him, well, did he improve? And Genki said, well, actually not very much. He didn't improve, but he continued to play. Right? He continued to play. And that's everything, right? If you're playing to win, you're playing for the wrong reason. If you're playing to please others, you're playing for the wrong reason. You should be doing it because you love it. And if you love it, then winning and losing are not important. Not important. So, yes, enlightened people fail their exams. Enlightened people make investment mistakes, like this, whatever. These are like the two hands of practice. It's like the world disappears and then you embrace the world. And then the world disappears and then you embrace the world. And then the world disappears and then you embrace the world. Don't forget to make the world disappear, right? If you don't practice and you don't cultivate mushin, that's a problem. But then don't forget to embrace the world. These are like the two hands of Zen practice. And our way is like a balance, right? Balancing these two all the time. When Hyakujo Osho delivered a certain series of sermons, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man said, "I'm not a human being. In the old days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was the head monk living here on this mountain. One day a student asked me, 'Does a man of enlightenment fail his PhD exam or not?' I answered, 'No, he does not.' One day a student asked me, 'Does a man of enlightenment ever lose his temper?' I said, 'No, he does not.' One day a student asked me, 'Does a man of enlightenment,'" you can fill in the blank, right? I said, "No, he does not. Since then, I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give the turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation?" Hyakujo said, "He does not ignore causation." Now, I know we've been sitting here for a long time, but what a disappointing answer, right? What a disappointing answer. He does not, it sounds like legal talk, right? Well, he doesn't ignore causation. See, that's the koan. This koan has a catch. What does it mean, he doesn't ignore causation? That sounds like double talk to me. See, he doesn't. What does that really mean, see? Really mean? He doesn't ignore. So that's your koan, right? You know, when you fail your exam, that is your true self. And that's the truth. And the proper response is to put your hands together in gratitude. Say, "I will try harder next time." Right? When you fall flat on your ass on the ice in front of millions of people, can you imagine? And you can get up and say, "I love skating. I've learned so much. That's Buddha. That's the voice of Buddha." You know, Sasha Cohen spoke in the voice of Buddha. That's what Baijiang means. Right? That's what Baijiang means. Hyakujo said he does not ignore causation. No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, "I am emancipated from my life as a fox. I shall remain on this mountain." Hyakujo had the director of the monks strike the gavel and inform everyone that there would be a funeral service for the dead monk. The monks wondered at this, saying, "Everyone is in good health. Nobody is in the sick ward. What does this mean?" After the meal, Hyakujo led the monks to the foot of the rock and poked out the dead body of a fox and performed the ceremony of cremation. Mumon's comment, not falling under causation? How could this make the old monk a fox? Not ignoring causation, how could this make the old man emancipated? If you come to understand this, you will realize how old Hyakujo would have enjoyed 500 rebirths as a fox. And if you practice long enough and you practice deeply enough, live in Mushin, every rebirth is wonderful. In this life you fall on your ass, in this life you fall on your ass, in this life you fall on... What a wonderful thing to be alive.